the future of bionic eyes, and more coming up on today's episode of Lace and Tech News. Hey, Gadgeteer, you're just in time for the latest episode of the world's only 3-in-1 show on tech, gadgets, and gaming news. That's right, this is Lace and Tech News. My name is Taylor Merrick, and if you're new here, hit that subscribe button right now so that you don't miss the next episode. We do this every single day, except Saturday and Sunday, so be sure you subscribe so that you don't miss out. Also, an exciting announcement, we're having a giveaway that you could enter to win. Head on over to technewsgadget.net/giveaway. The giveaway is good. Winner will be picked at the end of the month. And if you want more details on what goodies or goodie, I'm not going to spoil it. I'll have you go take a look for yourself. Head on over to technewsgadget.net/giveaway. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to let us know what part of the show that you like by hitting a like button down below, or by leaving a comment if you don't like anything. I'd rather like to know, you know, what you're liking, what you're not liking, so that would be appreciated there. But if you're listening via podcast, you can just continue doing what you're doing. Our feature story is, well, tomorrow's bionic eyes will have predator vision, so I'll be getting into that. We'll also be taking a look at Huawei announcing its own alternative to Android, Harmony OS. Also, we'll be taking a look at robocall blocking apps caught sending your private data without your permission. And in gadget news, we'll be taking a look at Drone Racing League is making its Racer 4 UAV available to all. A little bit of juicy details. It can go from 0 to 90 in a second. It's quite impressive. And somebody's texting me. Jeez. Don't they learn? Also, we'll be taking a look at Twitch launching its own broadcasting software, but not to be outdone, Discord will soon offer game streaming, but it's going to be different than what Twitch has going on. And finally, in gaming news, we'll be taking a look at PUBG Mobile Lite, a smaller game with some big changes. But before we can, let's take a look at today in tech history. All right, today is August 9th, 2019. On this day in history, in 1991, astronauts aboard the Space Shuttle Atlantis mission STS-43 used an Apple Macintosh portable computer to send what is considered the first email from space. Using the Apple Link online service, Atlantis astronauts Shannon Lucid and James Adamson sent the following message. Hello, Earth. Greetings from the STS-43 crew. This is the first Apple Link from space. Having a great time. Wish you were here. Send cryo and RCS. Hasta la vista, baby. We'll be back. You know somebody's watched Terminator that day, so. The Apple Link software on a Macintosh was specifically configured to connect to NASA's communication system, which allowed the shuttle to interface with Apple's proprietary network from space. The Macintosh Portable itself only had very minor modifications to operate in space. And there you go. First email from space in 1991. Also on this day, in 1898, the U.S. Patent Office awards a patent to Rudolf Diesel for his diesel internal combustion engine, and that was the first time the diesel engine was patented in the U.S. And finally, on this day, in 1927, computer pioneer Marvin Minsky was born. Minsky has made many major contributions to computer science in the areas of AI, cognitive psychology, mathematics, computational linguistics, robotics, and optics. In 1987, Minsky wrote the landmark book The Society of Mind, which proposed that human consciousness and thought processes were decomposable into a series of mini-minds or agents, each of which performed specific functions. Minsky received a BA and PhD in mathematics at Harvard and Princeton. There he envisioned a rat-in-a-maze neural network simulator, which became the SNARC, the Stochastic, I don't know, neural analog reinforcement calculator, something along those lines, built with assistance from Dean Edmonds. His other inventions include mechanical hands and other robotic devices, the confocal scanning microscope, the Muse synthesizer for musical variations, and the first logo turtle. His later work focused on understanding the connections between computers and common sense reasoning. And if you happen to hear any noises in the background or ripping up the road, like less than a block away from me, so sorry if you hear any of that noise, but shouldn't affect the show too much. If it does, let me know with a comment or let me know on Twitter. With that out of the way, let's head on over to today's feature story. All right. Tomorrow's bionic eyes will have predator vision. This is quite impressive. And in case you guys are wondering, all the articles mentioned in today's show can be found over at technewsgadget.net. Whether through illness or injury, 36 million people suffer from blindness worldwide, and until just a decade ago, those afflicted had little chance of regaining their sight. In 2009, doctors at the University of Manchester implanted the first Argus II bionic eye in a patient. Now, 10 years later, the makers of the Argus II are trialing a more capable artificial vision system, one that's implanted directly into the patient's brain. It's called the Orion Visual Cortical Prosthetics System. That's a mouthful. And it's been developed by Second Sight Medical Products. Like the Argus II before it, the Orion system consists of a small camera mounted on a pair of glasses to capture images, a video processing unit to convert what the camera sees into electrical impulses the wearer can interpret, and an implant that stimulates the user's brain to create a perceived image. However, unlike the Argus II, which used implants that clamped onto the patient's optic nerves, the Orion implant sits directly on the brain itself. Oh boy. Interesting, but indeed helpful, and you wouldn't even know the difference if you had this installed. This implant is installed via a small craniotomy in the back of the patient's head above the occipital lobe. They put the electrode array in there between the two halves of the brain against the visual cortex. Then they basically screw the electric package into the skull just next to the craniotomy. This electronics package contains a small transmission coil that wirelessly receives data and power from the system's external parts. And this is actually quite impressive. They actually have a video that goes along with it. The installation process requires an overnight hospital stay, followed by a 3 to 4 week recovery period before the unit is even turned on. At that point, the user is fitted with glasses, various components are connected, and really what you're hoping them then is for them to start seeing spots of light, phosphenes, and something from the electronics, but then there's quite a bit of work that has to happen. So this is not like you just install it in your head and you're good to go. They have a 60 electrode array electronically stimulating the visual cortex, and each one needs to be individually tuned to provide the most distinct and discernible spot of light possible. This process requires weeks to months of adjustment to perfect. Next step is establishing a spatial map, ensuring that each electrode is energized in the correct spot on the patient's brain. And this involves having the patient repeatedly tap to a specific spot, the surface on a tablet, when, say, electrode 32 is energized. And it's done over and over and over and over again. And hopefully they map a spatial map and it actually works. And this is actually pretty impressive. So they are undergoing a study, and it is safe for larger trials. So overall, for the number of subjects that they have at that point, they feel it's a good and very safe starting point, and the physician community would agree with it. However, in terms of getting an FDA approval on this one, it's quite a long one. So there's no option in terms of being the first or whatever. You're just going to wait forever until the FDA figures out how to do it. But what's exciting is where the Second Sight team plans to take this technology next. In addition to packing more and more electrodes into the array to improve the image fidelity, expanding the electrode count to between 150 to 200 channels, looking to make a lot of improvements on the software side, and they're also looking into distance filtering. So, article goes on to say we're still years away from having the technology behind Jordi LaForge's visor, but enabling the visually impaired to hunt an elite team of commandos through the South American rainforest is a pretty solid trade-off. So, it's actually quite impressive. I mean, I love, this is why I like having the show, why I like having the website, because I like covering cool news like this, because this is what makes it cool, you know. Groundbreaking technology. Yeah, we can do this now, we can do that now, because of technology, this can happen, and it's all meant to help or complement a normal human existence, if not augmented in some way, so that it can be a bit more helpful in terms of quality of life and life expectancy. But in this case, quality of life, you're able to see, and it's not exactly vision like we have, but it's roughly close enough so that you can distinguish predator vision. But do you guys want predator vision? Let me know down in the comments. With that out of the way, let's head on over to the next story we got. All right, Huawei is finally releasing its homegrown alternative to Android. You see, after a US crackdown forced Huawei to imagine a future without access to Android, the Chinese smartphone giant, obviously, like we had figured, began working on its own alternative to Google's ubiquitous mobile OS. Now at the company's annual developer conference, Huawei has finally shared the first official details on its homegrown alternative to Android. Called Harmony OS, as it's known in English, was described by Huawei's Consumer Business Group CEO Richard Yu as the company's future-oriented software platform, a platform they have been in development for more than 2 years. See, I knew they had something under the works. With Harmony OS, Huawei is looking to create a unified operating system that can work across a wide variety of devices, including IoT gadgets, smart screen devices like TVs, and eventually smartphones and tablets. That said, for the immediate future, the Huawei phones will continue to run Android. Harmony OS is billed as an open-source platform based on a microkernel framework similar to Google's Fuchsia platform and includes a compiler that supports multiple coding languages including C++, Java, and Kotlin. Huawei says its use of a microkernel architecture and deterministic scheduling engine allows Harmony OS to quickly and more accurately handle resource management, which can result in lower latencies and IPC performance, up to five times more efficient than existing systems. And unlike Android, Huawei claims that its use of a multi-device IDE allows the company to develop a single version of its OS that can be deployed across a range of devices. This stands in contrast to Android, where device makers are forced to tweak the OS individually for every single device, which is one of the major factors responsible for causing delays in software updates and Android fragmentation as a whole. However, even though Huawei says Harmony OS is open source, the company does not plan to allow users to have root access to the OS, obviously, which they claimed would be a serious security risk, and for obvious reasons. But, quite an important milestone, it will be rolling out Harmony OS gradually over the next 3 years, starting with smart screen devices like wearables, car infotainment units, and Huawei Vision, which we'll be hearing about more in the coming days from them before bringing Harmony OS smartphones and tablets down the line. It seems like they want to test it out and make sure it works, and then roll it out. So, what do you think? Interesting, not? If you're in China, it might be a good option for you. And in terms of Harmony OS, it might be a better alternative to Android. But we'll see how it shakes out, right? All right, moving on to some more news. Robocall blocking apps caught sending your private data without your permission. Now remember, robocall apps promise to rid your life of spoofed and spam phone calls, but are they as trustworthy as they claim to be? One security researcher says many of these apps can violate your privacy as soon as they are opened. Dan Hastings, a security consultant at cybersecurity firm NCC Group, analyzed some of the most popular robocall blocking apps, including Trapcall, Truecaller, and Hiya, and found egregious privacy violations. Robocalls are getting worse, with some getting tens or dozens of calls a day. These automated calls demand you pay the IRS a fine you don't owe or pretend to be tech support. They often try to trick you into picking up the phone by spoofing their number to look like a local caller. But as much as the cell networks are trying to cut down on spam and taking forever to do so, many are turning into third-party apps to filter their incoming calls. But many of these apps, says Hastings, sends user or device data to third-party data analytics companies, often to monetize your information without your explicit consent, instead bearing the details in their privacy policies. One app, Trapcall, sent users' phone numbers to a third-party analytics firm, AppsFlyer, without telling users, neither in the app nor in the privacy policy. He also found Truecaller and Hiya uploaded device data, including device type, model, software version, among other things, before a user could accept their privacy policies. Those apps, said Hastings, violate Apple's app guidelines on data use and sharing, which mandate that the app makers first obtain permission before using or sending data to third parties. Many of the other apps aren't much better. Several other apps said, according to Hastings, tested immediately, sent some data to Facebook as soon as the app loaded. Without having a technical background, most end users aren't able to evaluate what data is actually being collected and sent to third parties. Said Hastings, privacy policies are the only way that a non-technical user can evaluate what data is collected about them while using an app. Now, none of the companies acted on emails from Hastings warning about the privacy issues, he said. It was only after he contacted Apple when Trapcall later updated its privacy policy. But he reserved some criticism for Apple, noting that app privacy policies don't appear to be monitored, as he discovered with Truecaller and Hiya. Privacy policies are great, but apps need to get better about abiding by them, said Hastings. If most people took the time to read and try to understand privacy policies for all the apps they use, they might be surprised to see how much these apps collect, he said. Until that day, end users will have to rely on security researchers performing manual deep dives into how apps handle their private information in space. So, Hiya conceded that it sends some device data to third-party services when opening an app, but claims it doesn't collect any personal information. We're currently working on strengthening our privacy even further by resubmitting our apps so that even this basic device information is not shared prior to explicit consent by the users. So, in terms of this, is this really a privacy violation to be concerned about? I don't know. I feel like to some extent, like, you should maybe be concerned, but to the other extreme, think of it this way. It's not that big of a deal. What are you going to say? Well, this guy's running around with an iPhone 7 running the latest iOS. No, you just, all you're going to know is user, iPhone 7, latest operating system. That's not much identifiable information. Where it gets concerning is where it's personally identifiable information. General information like that, when it comes to privacy, is it really private? Is it really not? See, this is exactly what starts off the whole question of how much privacy is too private, how much isn't. Is there really reason to be concerned if somebody finds out that you walked 5 miles? They don't have any more information than that. All they know is that you walked 5 miles. And it could be either A, you posted it publicly on Facebook and said I walked 5 miles, or an app tracked it for you. Is that really a big deal? Is that really, what if you did both? And then you complained to the app that tracked you walking 5 miles and reported them for privacy violations or antitrust to the FCC? I have no idea. This is where it gets stupid, honestly. what do you guys think? Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There isn't really much more to the article, but I guess do your due diligence before downloading an app to the best of your ability. And then obviously if it contains personal private details that will directly identify you and they're not securing that data, that's cause to be concerned. So outside of that, I think we're pretty safe. Moving on to some gadget news, Drone Racing League is making its Racer 4 UAV available to all. Now, when the new season of Drone Racing League premieres on August 11th, its competitors will be racing the fourth iteration of its high-speed first-person view drone. That machine, called the DRL Racer 4, can accelerate from 0 to 90 miles per hour in under a second, has a carbon fiber canopy, and has 1,000 colorful LED lights. And thanks to the league's decision to enter the consumer drone market, you will be able to pre-order a street-ready version of your own. The league has launched the DRL Street Racer 4 Street as a Kickstarter project with an estimated delivery date of April 2020. After many, many requests to purchase the Racer 3, we made sure to answer the demand with the street version of our next-gen drone. The description reads, the league promises a true field-ready version of the DRL Racer 4 drone with the same power configuration. Now, here's the really crazy thing. For those of you who say, is it seriously a drone racing league? Yeah. I actually went and I looked into it. I think like several months ago, I actually watched an event live for a little bit, and I was impressed. I was like, are these people seriously racing a drone with a right now? First person view camera, you know, the whole headset and controls and everything. And there's sponsors behind it too. This is an actual league. This is an actual quote esports. People are racing drones for a living. Seriously? Yes. Seriously. People play chess for a living. People play checkers for a living. You can play drone racing for a living. I'm not making this up. This is pretty impressive. This electronic system, the DRL Racer 4 drone, will be redesigned to support off-the-shelf and plug-and-play parts so you can easily find components and fix it if it breaks. See, my reasoning or thought process behind why they're making this street-ready and you can, you know, support them on Kickstarter and for a certain dollar amount, you can actually get your own drone that way is they would love to see more people enter the league. They'd love to see more people practice, more people join the league, more people to have fun with drone racing and everything that it entails. All you're literally doing is you're racing a drone in the air at like 90 miles an hour. So obviously you're going to have to be pretty good. It's kind of like akin to NASCAR. Like when you play NASCAR video games, this is actually, you're actually racing a drone in real life, and you're going to buy it for street view and then hopefully move on and go competitive. So this is what my reasoning is behind it. So the only bad news is the league can only offer shipping within the US at the moment, though it may open orders to other regions if there's enough demand. If you are in the US, you'll have to pledge at least $600 to get our DRL Racer 4 street drone as a reward. Otherwise, you can just support them and you probably get some other perks off of that. So they actually have a video that goes along with it. I mean, look at this puppy. Look at it. I mean, these are the collars and everything. You can do whatever you want it to. Here it is. Yeah, you thought I was making this up. No, this is actually like visually impressive. I mean, if you want, like, this at to some point reminds me of Speed Racer. Drone racing reminds me of being Speed Racer. All the lights, all the show, everything that goes along with it. So if this is something that you're hearing of for the first time, I'd encourage you to go look into it. If not, well, here you go. At least you know there's drone racing as a backup option in case your streaming career doesn't kick off. And yes, by streaming career, I mean on Twitch. Speaking of Twitch, Twitch has launched its own broadcasting software, eliminating the need for OBS or any other third-party software. Now, you see, Twitch has become the digital watering hole of many gamers' lives, a place where they gather and watch streamers chat and play through their favorite games. Watching it is easy. Open a stream and you're good to go. But for budding content creators who don't know much about how to stream on Twitch, the process is a little bit more involved. Although, seriously, like, guides and tutorials for free exist everywhere you can find them. Mainly YouTube is a great resource, including Reddit. But today, Twitch launched Twitch Studio, a first-party broadcasting software that should make starting your streaming career a bit easier. Up until now, streamers big and small have relied on third-party broadcasting software like OBS or Streamlabs in order to mash together the outputs of your game, camera, and microphone into what's seen and heard by the viewer. Twitch Studio aims to cut OBS and other software out of the equation, simplifying the process and hopefully making it easier to start your streaming career. We've been listening to our users give us feedback, talk about their experience, how they started streaming, and how they progress. Twitch Director of Product Management Chen Chen told The Verge, and one really consistent pain point is, well, multiplayer entertainment is quite fun, it's really engaging, but the bar to get started is quite high. Twitch Studio first offers guided setup to help first-time streamers configure their mic and webcam. It then gives the user some basic templates to customize the look of their stream, as well as some community-building tools like an activity feed and alerts for new followers. Twitch Studio is available now by way of a closed beta with limited features and currently only supports Windows 7 or newer. You can read more about the software on the Twitch blog or sign up for the closed beta at twitch.tv/broadcast/studio. So exciting news there. If you're streaming on Twitch, you might finally have a simpler way to connect and get your streaming career started if you don't want to do drone racing. You see what I did there? Oh, but not to be outdone, and you just saw me changed over. I'm sorry. I do all the visuals myself here at the show. Octavius, he's not even here. Octavius told me he would be my producer, but he's not even. I'm looking at. He's not nowhere in the room to be found. Anyways, Discord will soon offer game streaming, but it's going to be very different than Twitch. Discord will be launching a feature called Go Live for its desktop application on August 15th. It will allow anybody with a PC to stream video of their game in any voice channel to up to 10 people at a time. Go Live is intended to give people the feeling of gaming in a living room with your friends, and it shows. It works based on Discord's game detection, the same feature that shows your friends what you're playing when you're playing it. Now, the feature will work in any server, although fully boosted servers will have options for higher quality streams, and so will anyone with Nitro. There's no limit server-wide to how many people can go live, and multiple people can even stream in the same voice channel. It's also a server-level feature, which means that admins can turn the feature off if they'd like. The feature is a very low latency. In a demo that The Verge saw here, the author at least, the stream was stable and just about real-time. Mixer, you might want to pay attention to Discord. I mean, Microsoft, you might want to pay attention. Yeah, Skype, real time. You want real time in terms of chat and low latency and everything? Pick up Discord for your chat. Anyways, and not Skype. Go Live isn't taking aim at Twitch, Mixer, or any of the other streaming platforms. There's no webcam support for one thing, and it's limited to 10 viewers because of bandwidth restrictions and latency goals, both of which seem hard to overcome. Mac and Linux computers won't be supported. Windows Core users run Windows, but Mac and Linux users can watch from a browser. Discord eventually plans to bring out a mobile version for spectators as well. With the addition of Go Live, Discord appears to be positioning itself as the place for gamers to hang out. So, Yeah. What do you think? Interesting? Not interesting? I'm actually wondering if I should just hop back on over to Discord and use that for server community forum talk thing. I don't know. Let me know down in the comments down below if you're excited or not, or let me know on Twitter at TechNewsGadget. And finally, we got some gaming news for you guys. PUBG Mobile Lite is a smaller game with some big changes. Now, PUBG Mobile Lite, a version of the popular Battle Royale hit game designed to work with a wider range of smartphones, is now out on Google Play in several regions of Southeast Asia, South Asia, North Africa, and South America. PUBG Mobile, a spin-off of the popular PC and console game PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds, is already the world's highest-grossing mobile game. It earned $167 million in July, according to mobile analytics firm Sensor Tower, and amassed more than 50 million daily players as of June. This new version will likely only increase their already huge mobile presence, especially when it becomes more widely available. Now, the game will have some significant changes to help it run on less capable hardware, as well as to encourage faster matches. Games will be played on a smaller map that fits 60 players, down from the standard 100 players in other versions of PUBG. There will also be more loot, and players can heal themselves in any stance except prone. And to make shooting more accurate on weaker network connections, PUBG Mobile Lite will have enhanced aim assist, no bullet drop effect on longer distance shots, and less weapon recoil. So, in terms of download space, it requires 490 megs of free space to download, compared to 1.6 gigs for the latest version of PUBG Mobile. It is designed to run on devices with less than 2 gigs of RAM as well. Tencent, the creators of PUBG Mobile Lite, says the game will be available in Europe and North and Central America soon. So, yeah, it looks like they're just going to be upping their game there. So, what do you guys think? You going to be playing PUBG Mobile Lite? It's at least for, you know, smaller, weaker smartphones that need, you know, needs must can't be upgraded to anything better than they already are. They're kind of like out-of-the-box operating versions that can't run any better. So, is this an option for you guys that might get you back in the PUBG, the Mobile Lite version? Or are you just fine playing a regular mobile version? Or are you not even playing a game? I don't know. I don't play it. I don't exactly have a need to play it, but I know some of you are interested about PUBG, so I wanted to make sure to let you guys know on the news. And with that, that wraps it up for, well, this article at least. As you can tell, I've been having quite an interesting day. Work going on outside my window, so my apologies for any noise in advance. And I seem to be a little bit distracted because I have things going on like crazy all the time. You don't even know, but it's all worth it, all fun. But that wraps up this episode of the latest in tech news. Thanks for tuning in, guys. New episodes every weekday, so obviously we're not going to be having one tomorrow or Sunday. We will be back on Monday. Latest in tech news can be found on every major platform, including Apple, Spotify, Google, YouTube, Stitcher, Overcast, and more. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to let us know by clicking that like button and by leaving a comment. And if you're listening on the podcast, head on over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review, or leave a review in any app that you're listening to it on. Also, double check that you are subscribed so that you don't miss the next episode. I'm your host, Taylor American. Remember, for the latest in tech, gadget, and gaming news, visit technewsgadget.net. Pretty much, keep being awesome, guys, and I'll see you on the flip side.